From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the August 2023 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, the diplomatic section. This month, we examine the often overlooked story of GCNCS's work on diplomatic codes and ciphers. This vital work predated work on military codes, beginning when GCNCS was created in 1919. Work continued throughout World War II, with some staff eventually leaving Bletchley Park to carry on as the Government Communications Bureau in Berkeley Street, London. In this special episode, our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, is joined by GCHQ's departmental historian, Dr. David Abratat, to discuss all things diplomatic and beyond. Special thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
Welcome back to Bletchley Park, Dave. Good to have you on the podcast again.
Thank you for having me.
This month, we're talking about diplomatic and commercial. Many people will have heard of the military aspects of Bletchley Park and GCNCS, so Enigma and all of these things, but we're heading off in a slightly different direction this episode. Can you briefly define for me what diplomatic and commercial SIGINT is?
Of course, Kando. As you rightly say, a lot of the focus of Bletchley's past has been focused on the service sections, the military section, the naval section, and the work they did against the Enigma and the Lorentz. But there's always been an enduring aspect of GCNCS, Government Code and Cipher School's history, which is focused on diplomatic interception. And it goes back to before GCNCS was formed in 1919. And the tendrils of that were MI1B, which was part of the War Office, which was a small crypt analytic team working ostensibly against German military codes and ciphers. And then there was Ream 40, which was part of the Admiralty, working against the German Imperial Navy communications. Both of those organisations, yes, they were working against service interception, but they were also very, very involved right the way through the First World War against diplomatic communications. So these are communications between what we in the UK call the Foreign Office, so the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or the Foreign Office, with their outlying missions, their embassies, their consulates, and often those communications were transiting via the telegraphic cable network. And as radio technology was evolving, we're also talking about wireless telegraphy. So diplomatic communications have been a vital theme right the way through our prehistory. And they give us really good insight into the political manifestations of a country, but you can also get insights into espionage operations, even surprisingly, military campaign planning, military dispositions and tactics.
But you were saying about the involvement of these sections in World War One. But diplomatic, it's not just a wartime activity, is it? Because we're looking particularly at GCNCS beginning in 1919.
Yep.
This kind of SIGINT is just as important in peacetime as it is in wartime.
Definitely, yeah. One of the most famous stories that emerged in the First World War was the Zimmermann telegram, which is arguably one of the most famous pieces of SIGINT history because of the outcome, which was to bring America into the First World War in 1917. And that was purely down to some diplomatic intercept from a telegram that was sent by Arthur Zimmermann, who was a German foreign minister at the time, proposing alliance with Mexico, essentially trying to do a distraction technique because the Germans wanted to carry out unrestricted submarine warfare in the North Atlantic, which might bring the Americans into the war, which they wanted to avoid at all costs. So the Germans needed a distraction. So this whole ploy of proposing alliance with Mexico, giving German support for Mexico to invade America, to retake the lands of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. That particular telegram was enciphered. It was intercepted in transit in the UK, and it was passed to some of the cryptanalysts at Ream 40. So Nigel de Grey was one of the famous cryptanalysts that worked on it and partially decrypted it within a few hours. The gravitas of what we had in front of us was seismic, and it was passed to the American delegation in London. Subsequently, it made its way to Washington, and by April 1917, the US Senate declared war on Germany. You know, these things are significant. You know, diplomatic communications can be vitally important.
And the reason GCNCS and its predecessors have access to this stuff is basically because Britain controls the cable network around the whole world, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. And certainly cable censorship was at play until 1919, so they had full access because all the transatlantic telegraph cables were routing through the UK, so we had full access to the traffic going through the UK. We mentioned commercial. Now, commercial is very different from diplomatic, and it was never in the GCNCS mandate until 1938. But when we're talking about commercial traffic, we're talking about industrial relations, we're talking about industrial partnerships, the day-to-day logistics of industry, be that oil, gas, petroleum. But, you know, in the context of certainly going back to the First World War, the British Navy was adept and very comfortable in blockades, monitoring trade and shipping around the world. But commercial SIGINT wasn't really being done until 1938. And that was really on the cusp of a decision by Sinclair, Admiral Sinclair, and the Director of Naval Intelligence, who wanted a small section to be set up within GCNCS, but that really wasn't until 1938.
So we're talking about economic warfare, essentially, aren't we? I mean, we're talking grain supplies from Ukraine is in the news at the moment. That's exactly the sort of thing, you know, international trade contracts, deliveries, ships passing around the planet, moving stuff from one place to another is all being... And the other thing about that is a lot of that traffic is also in cipher, isn't it? Albeit with commercially available codes, but it's not just necessarily all in plain language.
Yes, that's right. Some of it was in plain text, some of it was in ciphered. Now, that sort of interwar period is quite important in the, what we're talking about here. We've got military strategists, people like Basil Littlehart, who talked a lot about, what was the quote he used, the strategy of the indirect approach, which is all about not having direct trench warfare on a battlefront, but to look at different ways of carrying out warfare. And that economic warfare was a real significant theme of military strategy during the 1920s and 30s, when the dominance of the British Navy would always help in that vein. He argued that it was a better way of carrying out warfare, and it's easier to deliver a decisive blow through economics rather than having a battle with your adversary. And there's two aspects during the 1930s which is also worth mentioning, the Abyssinian War and also the Spanish Civil War, which really reshaped thinking about the importance of diplomatic intelligence and how that would help support the warfighter. I mean, it seems a bit incongruous that you'd have diplomatic intelligence helping the warfighters from the military services, but it does in the context of what we're talking about here.
There's also the aspect of the preparation for the next war. I mean, one of the quite surprising things about the interwar period is once GCNCS is established in 1919, they're also carrying out SIGINT operations against countries that ultimately become our allies. And the spying on the US is something that a lot of people aren't aware of, but I've looked at the naval treaties after the First World War, because you have this situation where Britain, the USA, Japan, France and Italy basically come out of World War One with big navies, and they are the biggest navies in the world. And there is a consensus among the governments that they want to prevent an arms race, naval arms race, like the one that happened prior to 1914, where everyone was building ships as fast as they could and it was bankrupting all their economies. So they set out with a very honourable purpose, which is to let's have a disarmament treaty where we all minimise the number of ships we build. But inevitably, knowing the other negotiators' negotiating position before they turn up was really important. So GCNCS is reading American cables, they're reading Japanese cables, they're reading French cables, aren't they?
That's right. It was very much a global aspect of GCNCS's work, and it had a global reach because of the nature of Britain's control of global telegraphic cable routing, with the British Empire being, you know, certainly towards the tail end of our history. You know, we had access to a lot of the cable landing stations around the world, but we also had access through neutral countries like America and Sweden, access to content from their telegraphic cable access points as well. So we were in a good place, certainly at the start of the Second World War.
Yeah, I mean, there's a nice quotation. Alistair Denniston wrote a lengthy account of the pre-war GCNCS in about, it was 1944, wasn't it? You wrote it, something like that. And he covers diplomatic, and he gives a description of how successful he considered interwar interception to have been.
To sum up the cryptographic effort of 20 years on diplomatic traffic, we started in 1919 at the period of bow and arrow methods, i.e. alphabetic books. We followed the various developments of security measures adopted in every country. We reached 1939 with a full knowledge of all the methods evolved, and with the ability to read all diplomatic communications of all powers, except those which had been forced, like Germany and Russia, to adopt one-time pads.
One of the interesting things Denniston mentions there is the powers that were forced to use one-time pad. And this is one of the most secure forms of encryption, where you use a super encipherment, you have a numerical additive to your code, which is only ever used once. And that's what makes it basically unbreakable, isn't it? If you use one time pad correctly, you can't get into it. Rather notoriously, the Russians, their diplomatic ciphers are being read quite effectively, very effectively, by GCNCS from 1919 till 1927. But in 1927, there was a famous incident, the so-called ARCOS incident, where the, trying to remember what the acronym stands for, it's basically the Russian Cooperative Society, and they are a trade body dealing with imports and exports from the Soviet Union to Britain. But SIS was convinced that it was a front for Soviet intelligence. So in 1927, they got the Met to boot the doors down and went in and ransacked the building and stole everything. And then, if that wasn't bad enough, Stanley Baldwin, who was Prime Minister at the time, then just got up in Parliament and in the context of this, accused the Soviets of spying and gave evidence that wasn't even from the ARCOS raid. It was actually intelligence that had come from GCNCS. And what that did was it tipped off the Russians to the fact that we were reading all their codes. I mean, you could probably think of other examples today, but this is one of those things where having prime ministers announce how effective SIGINT is not the best plan in the world.
No, it doesn't go down well.
But it means that both the Soviets and the Germans have moved on to using what is a much, much more secure system. I mean, one of the German systems isn't unbreakable. We'll come back to that later. But certainly Soviet stuff becomes very hard to read after that point. So that gives us a pretty good idea of where diplomatic intelligence is coming from. But Dave, where is it going to? Who's it for?
Well, the primary customer for diplomatic intelligence was, as you can imagine, the Foreign Office. And, you know, it was a steady flow of reporting that were being distributed and circulated for the Foreign Office. Now, commercial was different, albeit there was a degree of synergy between diplomatic and commercial with diplomatic. But if you recall, September 1939, the Ministry for Economic Warfare had been established, and a significant platform for what was being driven in terms of government and military strategy for economic warfare, having a ministry that sole responsibility was for that reason. The commercial product was being pushed to the Ministry of Economic Warfare, but there was a vast array of other consumers, obviously services as well, the Admiralty, the Air Ministry, War Office, Treasury, as you can imagine, both intelligence services, MI5 and SIS, the Ministry of Food, the Petroleum Board, the Board of Trade, the Home Office, a lot of the overseas hubs like New Delhi, Melbourne and Washington, and a lot of the US departments like the US State Department and War Department. So this stuff was reaching not just a lot of UK customers, but it was reaching around the world as well to influence international government policy as well.
There's a finger of it in every pie, isn't there? It's going all over the place.
Yeah, it's probably more influential than you'd think in terms of, it was also a question here about scale and volume as well. Bletchley was, you know, an intelligence factory, as we know. And this was quite a small section in comparison to a lot of the other teams at Bletchley Park, but punched way above their weight, in my opinion.
The other collection aspect that we haven't talked about yet, because we talked a lot about cable companies, and in fact, you were saying about the cable censorship, the Official Secrets Act of 1920 actually obliged the cable companies to provide GCNCS directly with drop copies of everything that went across their desks. So the cable collection is pretty complete, if you imagine that the companies are basically giving them everything. But wireless is getting involved, isn't it? And the Foreign Office has its own Y stations, ultimately.
Yeah. And they were spaced around the country, I mean, as far north as Brora.
Whereabouts is Brora?
Brora's up in far north of Sutherland, so not too far from John O'Groats. And then you've got Hawklaw or Cupar, which is in Fife. So, you know, the far northeast of Scotland, right the way down until you get down to southern England. So places like Sandwich, Whitchurch, Wincombe, you've probably mentioned Knockholt in previous podcasts. There's also Denmark Hill, which is actually controlled by the Metropolitan Police. It wasn't a Foreign Office controlled white station, but wireless technology was coming of age. So the interception sites around the country were, you know, intercepting these communications, and at the forefront of it was diplomatic and commercial traffic.
How much of that is pre-war and how much of that grows during the war?
It certainly was on an exponential growth rate through the Second World War, and to a degree, Britain had a good way of shaping signals intelligence even at this stage. There's a good example of the Admiralty cutting a cable between Genoa and Malaga. So the Italian embassy's traffic was started to go over wireless telegraphy channels rather than through the cable networks. So starting to do traffic shaping, which is, you know, an interesting example as far back as the start of the Second World War.
Well, it's again, and it has a contemporary resonance because people are getting suddenly very worried about cables under the North Sea and all of this, all of our internet being cut off by the Russians. It's kind of what goes around comes around, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I've got a great quote from Nigel de Grey in a memo he wrote on the need to invest in diplomatic SIGINT. So this was dated the 26th of November 1940. In this brave new world, we have got to be prepared to follow trouble round the globe, vultures ready to take to wing at the merest indication of corpses. I think it's a wonderful quote.
The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing Street. On September the 1st, His Majesty's Ambassador in Berlin was instructed to inform the German government that unless they were prepared to give His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom satisfactory assurances that the German government had suspended all aggressive action against Poland and were prepared promptly to withdraw their forces from Polish territory, His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom would, without hesitation, fulfill their obligations to Poland. At 9 a.m. this morning, His Majesty's ambassador in Berlin informed the German government that unless not later than 11 a.m. British summer time, today, September the 3rd, satisfactory assurances to the above effect had been given by the German government and had reached His Majesty's government in London, a state of war would exist between the two countries as from that hour. His Majesty's government are now awaiting the receipt of any reply that may be made by the German government. The Prime Minister will broadcast to the nation at 11:15. That is the end of the announcement.
Coming up to the start of the Second World War, the organisation was put on a war footing in 1938 with the move towards Bletchley Park, the Munich crisis, and 15th of August 1939, GCNCS moves lock, stock and barrel into Bletchley Park. But that didn't include the diplomatic and commercial sections. They stayed put in Broadway.
That's Broadway buildings in London.
In London, yeah.
Broadway in...
They didn't move till the 26th of August, so it was a few days after the most of the rest of the organisation moved to Bletchley Park. But they actually moved into Elmer's School, which is just across the fence line, really. This was the first boys' grammar school, I believe, in Bletchley. And it was quite a small building, wasn't really big enough, even though both sections were quite small at that stage. Captain Ridley, he was famously also involved in moving the furniture in, I believe, and getting the teams ensconced in the building.
He was SIS's admin guy, wasn't he?
He wanted stuff. Yeah. They moved in and immediately went to seven-day working because of the importance of the work, and they worked to a two-shift pattern because the building, as I said, wasn't big enough, so they had to rotate and hot desking, as it was.
And Denniston says that there's about 30 of them at that point.
Yeah.
It's kind of the pre-war organiser. I'm just trying to think, because there's Denniston's emergency list. Do we know how much of that bumps up service sections versus how much it bumps up diplomatic? Do they get many people in diplomatic off the emergency list? Do you know? Or?
There was a steady increase in personnel. I think they peaked at about 50. So the three main country sections in the diplomatic section were all three Axis nations. So the Japanese, the Italians and Germans. And I think they peaked at 50 per section. And then there was obviously the other sort of rest of world teams and all their support staff. So I think they grew to just below 300 at peak. So there was a steady influx of new recruits coming in. A lot of them were women, and there were a significant number of cryptanalysts detached to the diplomatic sections because of the crypt work. Famously, Elmer School was the only part of the Bletchley campus that was ever hit by the Luftwaffe. So they'd hit the typist room and the telephone exchange, but I don't think there were any casualties. 20th of November. 1940.
There's a stick that a couple land on Elmer School.
Yeah.
One lands near the tennis courts, and then the others land in what was still parkland at that point, over where Block D and Block F would have been subsequently. But you can sort of, there's kind of a line of six hits, but the ones that do any damage are the ones that hit Elmer School.
Right.
But as you say, it was the middle of the night and no one was in there. So
I was in Hut 4, the German air section was in Hut 4, until roughly the end of 1940. We then moved into Hut 10.
So were you in Hut 4 when it was apparently bombed?
Oh, yes. I was in a village on the way to Buckingham. We knew there had been some German raids. And when I got into the office that morning after it, I heard that a bomb had fallen near the hut. And in my lunch hour, I went out to have a look at the crater. And it was about 5 feet. It wasn't very deep. It was a terribly small thing. And it was at the far end of Hut 4. There was a little hut there. It's not there anymore. It hadn't got a number. I think it was just a sort of an overflow hut in case storage or whatever. I heard that it was used sometimes by the typing pool, but I never saw anybody in it. And the crater was up against it. It had made it lean backwards towards the main building. And someone came along later that day and a couple of men sort of pushed it back. So there was a basis for this story that Hut 4 had been bombed and that the whole thing had been moved off its foundation. But that's all the basis there was. Hut 4 was utterly unaffected by it.
We've seen the move to Bletchley, the diplomatic and commercial sections moved to Bletchley in 1939. And in that early part of the war, they're actually, we were talking about spying on what become our allies. They continue to work on American traffic and on French traffic and subsequently Vichy French traffic. So their diplomatic section is still working behind the scenes in various areas you wouldn't necessarily expect, isn't it?
Yes.
In that way. And neutral countries, of course, are, you know, you need to know whether your enemy's going to be your enemy before they're your enemy, if that makes sense.
I think one of the interesting things that made me chuckle was the, I think there was some Italian representation on some of the peace negotiations, which involved the Vatican, and the diplomatic section started working on ciphers out of the Vatican. So interesting that we were monitoring the holiest of holies.
It's also because the Vatican is standing in as a sort of intermediary between quite a lot of belligerent countries, aren't they? So they're good people to spy on. But also all the countries in South America and China and all sorts of places. I mean, there's again, Denniston, by his own account, in 40-41, they were receiving intelligence for a total of 26 different countries. And something like 100,000 telegrams a year is the figure he gives, which is, what's that? That's 300 a day, isn't it? That's a healthy volume of traffic.
Yeah, bulk interception before we were using the phrase.
We talk about the volumes of things like Enigma, but that's one country, one system. I mean, 26 countries, every one of those countries has got its own cipher systems. I mean, a lot of them are very similar. A lot of people are using additive book codes, which once you know how to break them, the procedure is, it's tedious, but you can do it.
A year after the diplomatic and commercial section moved into Elmer School, there was a move to take the commercial section out and put them into Wavendon House, where I think they stayed until the 1942 reorganisation of Bletchley and the relocation back to London for the whole, this is a component of GCNCS's work. So Wavendon House has a part of this story as well.
Yeah, this is the place just to the east of Milton Keynes near Woburn, which is better known as a bomb out station because from when Diplomatic moved out, they moved some bomb machines in there, and it remains a bomb outstation until 44, at which point they shut it and just use it as a Wren billet. They originally, there was a suggestion that if Bletchley Park itself were critically damaged by an air raid or something, that Wavendon would be the backup property. And they set out to duplicate a lot of records and put them in the basement at Wavendon just in case they lost them. But then the records were growing at such a rate that that became impractical after a very short period of time, and they stopped doing it. Yeah, so that they are kind of, I think you said it when we were talking before, kind of wandering gypsies, aren't they? The diplomatic section, they go from pillar to post, which is a poor reflection on their importance in the organisation. And the other fact is that it's one of the sections that is directly managed by Denniston, isn't it? I mean, his métier really is diplomatic intelligence. That's what he does.
That's right.
My name is David A. Hatch. I'm the historian for the National Security Agency in the United States. In the 1930s, the United States Cryptologic Services exploited Japanese diplomatic communications and were working without much success against Japanese Navy communications. While the United States Cryptologic Service was interested in all the Axis powers, they looked at German communications, they looked at Italian communications, it was pretty clear that if war came to the United States, it would be against Japan. So the service cryptologic agencies began dealing with Japanese communications. The Army had the greatest success in the 1930s. They solved Japanese diplomatic communications, which were enciphered by a sophisticated machine. The Americans, in addition to solving this Japanese crypto system, developed and devised a machine that could analyze these communications automatically. This device enabled the Americans to read Japanese diplomatic communications on a near real-time basis. The U.S. Army, in working against Japanese diplomatic communications, nicknamed those communications Purple. When they devised a machine for automatic solution of these communications, they called it the Purple Analog. In 1940, the United States was neutral. Most Americans hoped to stay out of the wars that were raging in Europe and Asia. The United States military was weak. It was small. It was ill-equipped. Most Americans did not envision going to war again. However, President Franklin Roosevelt recognized the United States was not going to be able to stay out of the war. We had to prepare ourselves militarily. We had to find allies. He sent envoys to the United Kingdom to find out not only that the British would never surrender to the Nazis, but that they did have the means to continue to resist. Once convinced of that, Roosevelt saw that it was in America's interest to support the British. The British were fighting America's fight, a fight we were not ready for. To this end, he authorized discussions between the military experts of the American Army and Navy with their equivalents in the British Army and Navy. During these conferences, which a number of agreements were reached about sharing bases or obsolete destroyers, a number of support measures that could be done immediately. In the midst of this, the American and British technical negotiators suggested, how about exchanging information about cryptology? This was a radical idea, and in the United States, it had to go straight to the president, who agreed that it was a good idea, that it was something we could share, something that would benefit both countries. In the United States Army and Navy, there were in each service small cryptologic units. They were numerically small, but the practitioners were highly professional. They were brilliant people. They developed new analytic techniques, both to protect American communications from enemy cryptanalysts and to solve enemy messages. It was in this context that two from the Army, two from the Navy, were selected to make contact with the British. Once the political agreements had been reached that allowed this to happen, these four Americans were chosen to travel to the United Kingdom and begin sharing to the extent determined by the relationship as it developed. The Americans traveled in a British convoy across the Atlantic and were landed in Scapa Flow. The original plan was for the Americans to fly from the Orkneys down to London. However, the crates of cryptoanalytic devices that the Americans had brought would not fit in the designated airplanes, so they had to travel along the east coast of Britain by ship. While they were traveling, this ship was attacked by German aircraft. It was heavily strafed. In addition to the distress caused to the cryptologists, this had an interesting after effect. They were not the first, but they were among the first Americans to come under German fire. When they returned to the United States, not only could they share the cryptanalytic information that they exchanged with the British, but they could talk about the danger, about the urgency, about the threats to convoys as they had sailed across the ocean, and most chilling of all, of being under German air attack. They were landed in London. They were taken overland to Bletchley Park. They were tired. They were perhaps frightened. They were cold and a little bit wet, perhaps. But a warm welcome awaited them at Bletchley Park. They were among colleagues there.
It's probably worth talking about partnerships as well. This is very much a UK-driven enterprise. But as the partnership with the Americans really started in earnest from February 41 when the Sinkov mission came to Bletchley, it was clear that, the work that we'd done on Italian cipher systems was world-leading, and sympathetically, the Americans' work on Japanese cipher systems with the Purple analog access, there was a degree of needing to share. But I think, I've certainly read there's a degree of reluctance to share, certainly on the British side, with the work we were doing on neutral countries, with telegraph cable traffic that was transiting British cable sites. So there was a degree of reluctance, but you know, the Brusa agreement that was shaped in 1943, there was certainly an angle in that whole negotiation and fostering of that partnership because of the need to share with the Americans. You know, we needed access to Japanese traffic, and they'd done some fantastic work exploiting the Japanese ciphers. But it helped develop that partnership. So, you know, the diplomatic interception was, I think, you know, a key cornerstone of the shaping of Brusa, which would then become Yakuza in 1946.
I mean, one of the ironies of that I was alluding to earlier is GCNCS certainly has the ability to read State Department traffic, US State Department, basically the American Foreign Ministry.
Yeah.
The US State Department traffic right up until Pearl Harbor. And after Pearl Harbor, Churchill writes a very, very secret personal letter to Roosevelt, which is taken by hand. He couches it rather artfully. He says, "We've become aware that your codes might be vulnerable, and so we're going to tell you that you ought to change them in case somebody else apart from us can read them." It's a very roundabout way of saying, yeah, we can read all the State Department's messages. And he firmly asserts at that point that they're going to stop. But whether they did stop, who knows? He wrote a similar letter to Stalin, but, you know. And again, with the French, you have a situation where they are collaborating with the French against German traffic and all the work on Enigma with the Poles in Paris and everything else. But they are still reading French diplomatic traffic. And then, because the Vichy France then effectively becomes the other side, they keep going. So French section is kept busy.
I'm Stephen Freer, and I came to Bletchley first in 1941. I came from Trinity College at Cambridge. I was reading classics. So that was a good grounding for learning the rudiments of several other languages, such as Italian and Japanese. I went one day to the interview, which was in Oxford, and there for the first time I met Commander Denniston. And the summons to the interview had been sent to my home address, and sometimes in wartime the post was rather slow, so I didn't actually receive it at Cambridge until the morning of the day when I was supposed to be there. And I had just time to rush to the station and get the train. But I was wearing my most untidy clothes, and I hadn't had time to have anything to eat and drink. So I was in quite a bad temper when I got to the interview. And I remember Commander Denniston asked me, amongst other things, whether I was at all air-minded. Well, I wasn't, and I said so. My two brothers were both very interested in aircraft, but it was a thing that had never appealed to me. And apparently, this bluntness was a thing which impressed the interviewers, and they took me on. I went first to the training course in London, and my first day on the course was actually my 21st birthday. After a few weeks, the course was transferred to Bedford, and it was in June 1941 that I moved from Bedford to Bletchley. The people that I met when I first came were people like Commander Denniston and John Tiltman, who was one of the greatest cryptographers. I never met Dilly Knox because he died very shortly after I came to Bletchley. I met Alan Turing because one time in our section we had a mathematical problem connected with probability which none of us could solve because we weren't really mathematicians. And we were told that Turing was the man who would solve it for us, and he did. He was a very shabby, untidy man. In all the published pictures, he must have been smartened up, I think, especially for the occasion. But his mind was absolutely brilliant. In the spring of 1942, Commander Denniston, who was in charge of the whole outfit at Bletchley, moved to London. He was moved rather like a queen bee taking a new swarm to a new place. And Bletchley was taken over by Commander Travis. In London, I worked under Norman Sainsbury, who was an expert in Oriental languages and later became the keeper of the Oriental manuscripts at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. We worked in an office in Berkeley Street, which before the war had been a hat shop called Peggy Carter. And some of the hats were still stored in the basement and in the attic of the building. And our fire officer was very alarmed because he thought that straw hats were just about the most dangerous thing as a fire risk that there could possibly be. And then there was an offshoot from Berkeley Street, where I worked for some time in Aldford House in Park Lane. I was working there for the most part on Japanese diplomatic ciphers. We spent hours and hours copying things out and shuffling things to and fro to try to make them fit. And it was a great moment when we actually made the break and were able to read the messages. I was working at one time on a Japanese code book which had a limitation. There were four figure groups, and each group, the first three figures, were either all odd or all even. And this enabled us to work out a pattern so that we could set the messages in depth, which made it possible to break them. And then we could take the differences between the groups and find common differences, which were assumed to be differences between common groups. And so we could reduce all the various columns of our table to the same base, as it were. And then it was possible then, from there on, to start breaking the code book itself. The Japanese commercial attaché in Berlin seems to have invented a little cipher which was really almost a childish thing, and when we were working on it we thought that it was really perhaps not worth the trouble of doing. However, when other business was slack for some reason, we thought we might as well tackle this potty little thing, and did so. And we were told afterwards that the messages had been shown to Winston Churchill himself, because the Japanese attaché gave an estimate of the amount of damage which we had done to German cities in the latter stages of the war, saying what percentage of each had been destroyed. And our people found it very interesting to compare the Japanese report with the reports which our bombers themselves had made.
What this does is it brings us to 1942, and regular listeners will know that we've talked in the past about the change at the top when Denniston is moved sideways, if you like, or sideways and downwards, depending how much of a fan of Denniston you are. And Travis becomes the boss at Bletchley Park, and Denniston moves back to London as Deputy Director C. Deputy Director Civil and Deputy Director Services is Denniston and Travis, respectively. Where do you stand on that in terms of Denniston's management of Bletchley Park? It's one of those points that gets quite controversial, isn't it? Because some people feel that he was really hard done by,
yeah,
and that it was a demotion.
Yeah, you can interpret historical texts in lots of different ways, and I can see both sides of the story. You know, what happened happens. Was Travis a better leader to bring the organisation through 1942 and, you know, the real crux point of the Second World War, and turn the organisation on a trajectory to get to a better place? Was Denniston the right person to potentially do the same? I don't know. Sort of sit on the fence on this one, I think.
My understanding is that what happens is Stuart Mingus, who's C at the time, so nominally the boss of the whole thing, he gets a chat, Brigadier Van Cutsem, because at that point, Bletchley Park has been, and GCNCS has been growing like Topsy for 2 years, but not in a very organised way. And he says, right, somebody needs to look at this whole thing and suggest how we can allow it to expand in the future in a more sensible fashion. And Cutsem basically comes back and says you need to make all these various changes. One of the changes that C settles on, that Mingus settles on, is this service and diplomatic split. And I think he would have seen it as, an equal playing field, you know, that they were both equally important roles. But the fact that, and we'll talk about this in a minute, the fact that commercial and diplomatic subsequently leaves Bletchley Park and goes back to London demotes them in the historical perspective, doesn't it? People notice them less because they're not here. Which is unfair, I think. The way I always look at Denniston is that without him, you don't have a GCNCS fit for purpose in 1939. It is 20 years of his work, and particularly 2 or 3 years of his work from sort of 37 to 39, which is absolutely fundamental to the organisation. It wouldn't have succeeded without him.
Yep.
But he is, and diplomatic section continues to be, a more old-school code-breaking organisation in many ways. It's less mechanised, although they're using Hollerith for additive codes, but it's less mechanised. It's more, we use the distinction cottage industry versus factory. It's more, still more sort of cottage industry in that way. And so it suits him better. You get the impression that he continued to run diplomatic section with a management style that was very personal and individual. He knew everyone by name. He was, you know, a kind of very friendly guy that he could lean over your shoulder at your desk. And that doesn't work for an organisation of 5 or 10,000 people. You just can't do it. You need a different style of manager for that. And I think that's where Travis comes in. I don't see as much, don't know what you call it, bonhomie, humanity, interpersonality in Travis as you do in Denniston.
Yeah. Yeah, and certainly when he took the diplomatic section across to Berkeley Street. It was a similar size to the one that he'd taken to Bletchley Park in August 1939. It was a similar scale in terms of personnel numbers.
Yeah, the whole of GCNCS versus diplomatic section, they both end up being sort of 250 people roughly, don't they?
Yeah.
So in spring of 42, they go to number 7 to number 9 Berkeley Street, which I've known about sort of vaguely for years, but in preparation for this podcast, I actually properly had a look at a map, and I now know where it is. It's literally 50 yards up the street from the Ritz, isn't it? It's typical GCNCS territory, you know, round the corner from a nice hotel. If you're standing in front of the Ritz and you go up the street in front of you, about 50 yards on the right, is a building which is still standing, which was flats pre-war, and they took over two or three flats in there, and they subsequently took over number 6 to 7 next door as well, and they had more staff in there. One of the people who worked there was a chap called Philby. Philby with an F, not that Philby. Mm-hmm. Not Philby with a PH, he's somebody different. Philby gave an account of how the street front downstairs was actually a fashionable dress shop.
Back in Berkeley Street, we occupied 7 floors of a block of apartments over the ground floor establishment of Madame Richet, Couturier des Dames. Security was sketchy, and it was not unusual for a pretty girl to wander into our rooms asking for Madame Richet. The guard had been a watch repairer before the war, and he was usually busy mending our watches and failed to notice people passing him.
In the meantime, the commercial section also returned to London, but they didn't go directly to Berkeley Street. They went into Alford House, which is on Park Lane. I believe that's a BMW.
It's now the BMW dealership.
And they occupied the 2nd, the 5th and the 6th floors. Interestingly, it was a lot closer to the Ministry of Economic Warfare. So its primary customer, they were just around the corner. And they stayed there for the duration of the rest of the war, I believe. There were other sections also at Alford House. There was B section, which is another part of GCNCS, which worked on political illicit tasks like the Comintern, the Communist International Network. And there was also a teleprinter team based there until they moved to Knockholt. So it always had a GCNCS footprint.
This is something I was trying to track down. Philby refers to the Government Communications Bureau, but I haven't found very much other reference to this. So can you confirm or deny, Dave? The Government Communications Bureau?
It's a new one on me, David, but it wouldn't surprise me they had a cover for it.
Yes, yeah. They have a cover title. It's one I hadn't noticed before, and you know, you go to the sort of usual sources and it didn't appear, so I was like, ooh, has someone just made this up? But I think somebody that worked there said it, so it sounds reasonably pucker.
It's worth talking about what happened back at Bletchley Park. So in spring 42, about the same time that the diplomatic and commercial teams were taken back into London, Bletchley established the Intelligence Exchange, or IE team, which had a lot of symbiosis with the diplomatic and commercial teams and essentially acted as a bit of a coordination hub for their reporting, ensured the distribution of their output got to where it was needed, but just within the organisation itself, but also to the various service commands as well. If we look at how diplomatic intelligence also worked with military commands, there was no direct linkage between diplomatic and commercial and the military, and the intelligence exchange looked as though that was the because of the relationship they had with service commands. There's another Nigel de Grey quote: "The extracts of diplomatic dispatches from Berkeley Street helped to illumine the trend of events for those engaged solely with the military situation." This pertains to work with G2, so the intelligence cell within SHAEF, the Supreme Headquarters for Allied Expeditionary Forces. De Grey goes on to say, "Diplomatic correspondence which may, quote, guide the Supreme Allied Commander on the continent in dealing with the political situation that he might be expected to meet." Because diplomacy should never be separated from military campaigns. They have to be so heavily intertwined at this sort of level.
That's Clausewitz, isn't it?
Yeah. So the first Berkeley Street report that was issued to SHAEF was on the 14th of June 1944, but it was very much the intelligence exchange responsibility. They had ownership of the summary reports that were produced from the diplomatic and commercial traffic that were then sent onwards to the higher Allied commands. So the system, that sort of process was developing in 1942, 1943, and put them in good stead for, you know, the opening up of the Second Front in 1944.
Yeah, and one of the things somebody asked me about this earlier today, actually, was, which you may be able to shed some light on, was Japanese diplomatic in particular. Purple, again, it's a code-breaking procedure that's being shared with the US. The US broke it first. His work on purple and Japanese diplomatic, is that happening within diplomatic section, or is that happening in Japanese section, or is it happening in Washington, D.C.? How does that all fit together?
There was a Japanese section within the diplomatic, so there was the Axis countries all had a sizable country section within the diplomatic section within a section. But the dominance of the work on Japanese cipher and crypt was done by the Americans. There was a division of effort, if you will. But there's also a Japanese commercial section that was set up originally with just one member of staff. But as the war started to run on, there was a pressing need to bolster our understanding of Japanese industry and how we could go into this space on economic warfare. The commercial section of working on Japan grew, I think, to a couple of dozen personnel.
Because some of that, famously, with General Oshima, the Japanese diplomatic prior to Normandy, is fitting directly in because he's actually being shown military stuff. But then again, as you say, after the invasion, how European governments are reacting, very, very important.
It's also worth mentioning there was a team within the diplomatic section which was called Distribution and Reference, or DNR. That was run by Eric Earnshaw Smith, who was a former member of MI1B before he joined GCNCS in 1919. It was a fairly small section, DNR, but quite an important one. But there was an awful lot of academics. So Earnshaw Smith's assistant was Professor Orr Jenkins, who was a professor of medieval history and modern Greek in Cambridge. So quite a lot of academic kudos within this small section. But they were very much the sort of reference library. They were the knowledge font of the various diplomatic missions around the world, you know, in terms of the personalities, in terms of conferences and treaties and any diplomatic incidents that had happened within those countries. They were the index laboratory. You know, you can imagine the volume of index cards they were storing and recording things on. And they were a critical component, the sort of knowledge wheel for the whole of the diplomatic section.
And is there a two-way relationship there? I mean, they're feeding intelligence to the Foreign Office, but can, you know, I'm just wondering whether UK overseas missions are kind of able to ask questions back, so to speak. So, you know,
I haven't seen anything to confirm or deny it, but I would imagine there would have been a lot of cross-pollination, certainly within SIS, of intelligence within country, of the who's who and what was going on, that would also reach back to DNR back here in Bletchley.
It's one of the sort of mythologies of Bletchley that nobody knows what's happening and they just feed product out. Actually, the back and forth liaison in all sections is much more significant than it has previously been given credit for, I think.
Top secret. From Japanese Ambassador Berlin to Minister for Foreign Affairs, Tokyo. Dated the 28th of May, 1944. On the 27th, I called on Foreign Minister Ribbentrop at Fushel and lunched with him, having about 2 hours' conversation. And during the afternoon of the same day, I had about 2 hours' conversation with Hitler at the Berghof. The following is a resume of my conversation with Führer Hitler. Section 3. Speaking of the Second Front, Hitler said that he himself thought that sooner or later, operations for the invasion of Europe would be undertaken. He thought that about 80 divisions had already been assembled in England. I accordingly asked the Führer if he thought these British and American troops had completed their preparations for landing operations, and he replied in the affirmative. I then asked him in what form he thought the Second Front would materialise, and he told me that, at the moment, what he himself thought was most probable was that, after having carried out diversionary operations in Norway, Denmark, the southern part of the west coast of France, and the French Mediterranean coast, they would establish a bridgehead in Normandy or Brittany, and, after seeing how things went, would then embark upon the establishment of a real second front in the Channel.
We've talked a lot about continuity and how diplomatic is in the blood of GCNCS from its foundation and indeed before. And that's kind of reflected in the staff, isn't it? You see a lot of older faces in diplomatic section. We're used to talking about the 1939 intake, if you like, for GCNCS on Enigma and things like that. But diplomatic, there's a lot more people from earlier. And one I came across is Ernst Vetterlein. He was a codebreaker for the Tsar in Russia originally. He cut his teeth doing Tsarist SIGINT. But come the revolution, he defected, would be the, I don't know if that was the relevant term at the time, but he headed west and offered his services to both the French and the British. And Philby, who worked in diplomatic section, again has a rather nice anecdote of Vetterlein's arrival in London.
He escaped to Russia in a Swedish ship which was searched by the Russians, who failed to find Vetterlein and his wife. It is said that the French and British organisations were anxious to get him, and Vetterlein simply sat there and said, "Well, gentlemen, which will pay me the most?" When he deposited his first cheque at a London bank, he was asked for references, to which Fetty replied, "Pardon me, it's my money. Where are your references?" Much of his English had been learnt from reading Nelson Lee and Sexton Blake, and so many of his sentences were punctuated with phrases like, "He was a rotter," and "Who has burned my pencil?"
It does get quite difficult from a historical point of view, because the accounts of how diplomatic section functioned, if they're written by some of the older school World War I codebreakers, they paint a different picture from some of the younger people. You get this sort of younger codebreakers saying, "Oh, all these old farts turned up who didn't want to come in till 10 o'clock in the morning," and all this kind of thing. And on the other hand, you've got the older codebreakers going, "Well, we knew what we were doing. We could get it all done by 5 o'clock. So what's the big deal?"
Certainly some of the most famous cryptanalysts of our history really were in this period and worked in this section. So Emily Anderson is certainly one of the most notable. That she recently had a book written about her time and her life by Jackie Chonner, University of Galway academic, Emily Anderson being from Galway. The book, Queen of Codes, available from all good online retailers. But she certainly was one of these exceptional cryptanalysts who worked during the First World War and cut their cloth during this period, and then went on to work in Egypt in 1940 and returned back in 43. She was a very, very dominant force in CBME, the Combined Bureau of Middle East.
She was an Italian expert, wasn't she, amongst other things?
Yes, yeah. And a very interesting career after the war with her research around Beethoven. And quite an individual. But certainly there was a few individuals that weren't keen on her.
Yes,
her style.
She's one of the people that, although Philby doesn't mention her by name, he gives enough aspects of her character to be able to tell he's talking about her.
Yeah.
And he's quite grumpy about her. He says that, you know, she used to pick and choose what she wanted to do. And he refers to her fetching her biography of Beethoven out of her bottom drawer when she didn't have anything better to do and doing that instead. Jackie points out that it wasn't actually a biography of Beethoven. It was an edition of Beethoven's letters, which is perhaps, you know, splitting hairs slightly. But it's certainly, you know, kind of different points of view. And it brings us back to one of the sort of historiographical issues with assessing the women who were at GCNCS, both pre-war and during the war, is the inherent prejudices of the time filter into the descriptions often the accounts, most of which are written by men. So trying to get a clear perspective on these people is sometimes difficult. And we're very lucky, as you said, that Emily now has a biography which tells her story properly. Another lady who was equally important, but was, we might call her, one of the new generation wartime hires, is Patricia Bartley. And she was brought on board because Emily Anderson happened to be billeted with her parents. She had a relatively typical background for a GCNCS recruit. She went to Oxford, where she studied philosophy, politics and economics, or PPE as it's known. This is the course that future politicians will do. People like David Cameron did PPE. But unfortunately, she wasn't very well, and her health prevented her from finishing the course. But Emily Anderson, who had been billeted with a different household in 1939, moved to the Bartley household, billeted on Patricia's father, who was an ex-Indian civil servant. He'd been a judge for Bengal pre-war. Emily took one look at Patricia and went, "She's prime GCNCS material," especially as their house was more or less outside the gate. Patricia Bartley's real claim to fame is the success she had with German diplomatic codes, because we discussed earlier how the Germans went over to one-time pad systems, and so there hadn't been a lot of attention paid to German diplomatic codes. But they had several different systems, and one of them wasn't actually one-time pad. It was an additive book code. But what made it difficult was, instead of getting a five-digit number that represents your word and then adding another five-digit number to it, which is what you'd normally do in the additive code, there were two additives. So you add a number and then you add another number, which makes it even more fiendish. And GCNCS had kind of given up on it. But they were lucky that when the British took over Iceland in 1940, one of the lesser-known campaigns of the World War II, Britain occupied Iceland and in the process occupied the German consulate. And there was a copy of the basic book, not the additive numbers, but the basic code number book, was captured in Iceland. And then the Americans were kind enough to hand over a page of additives that they'd stolen from a German diplomat who was passing through the Panama Canal. And in combination with this and a lot of mental sweat by Patricia Bartley, they were able to break into. The system was known as Floradora. I'm not quite sure why it was known as Floradora. It's something to do with the fact that it had a double additive, is why it's called Floradora. The Americans called it something more sensible. And she was able to break that system in 1943, which gave diplomatic section, you know, access to German diplomatic traffic which hadn't before. Unfortunately, the experience didn't do Patricia Bartley any good. She became ill again after that and had to retire. She's another of the Bletchley Park figures. Well, she's not a Bletchley, she's a Berkeley Street figure who should perhaps get more credit than she does. One of the features of her work actually is it's not brain power alone. The way you break additive systems is by compiling endless lists of numbers, and it's greatly assisted by Hollerith punch card machines. People who've been to our new Block A exhibition will have seen we now have a Hollerith card machine on display. And it was with the assistance of both UK and US Hollerith work that they were able to break the system. So before we were talking about these individuals within diplomatic section, we were talking about how it really has its own identity in terms of the kind of intelligence it's delivering and its range of customers and everything else. It's ultimately still part of GCNCS and GCHQ, isn't it?
Yeah, one theme of the work that has always been our history and our future, you know, this is a key strand of what this and any other signals intelligence organisation does around the world. You know, it's what happens.
It's bread and butter, peace or war, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I've got a statistic, and I don't know if you can corroborate this, Dave, but apparently there was a total of 72,624 decrypts from all the sections distributed to the Foreign Office between 3rd of September 39 and the 15th of August 1945. That's quite a total.
That sounds about right. I think Denniston gives that number.
Yeah.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
For a small section.
It's a big whack of knowledge. It's not like Enigma where they're character limited. A lot of those will be, we think of telegrams as being three or four words, but diplomatic telegrams are actually quite long documents, aren't they?
Yeah, they can be. Denniston announced his retirement to the workforce in December 44, and his replacement was going to be Edward Hastings, who was DD3. So he was a captain, Royal Navy, had served in Washington as C's senior representative, so C being the head of SIS. But he didn't formally retire until May 45. Despite what has been written and spoken about in terms of Denniston and his demotion, if that's the right word, what is clear is his legacy, one of the most significant strands of intelligence production within GCNCS, and prior to that, before we existed as an organisation, it's left an enduring legacy. And there's a great quote here from Philby.
Denniston was often referred to as the little man. And it is true he was of small stature. He was never panicked by anything, and the successes of his departments were speedily reported. It was wonderful to see him pick up the green phone, the one with the scrambler, after outstanding news, dial, and quickly say, "Denniston here. May I speak to C, please?"
And that legacy continues post-war, doesn't it?
Yeah, and keen enthusiasts who are listening, who've read our authorised history behind Enigma by Professor John Ferris, will know the diplomatic section's work continued post-war, working against cipher traffic on Jewish organisations during the Palestine Mandates, 46 to 48. And as many of you all know, GCNCS moved out of Bletchley Park to its new home in Eastcote in 1946, but the particular section that was working on the work on Palestine actually stayed in London in a location called 10 Chesterfield Street, which was a building that was also used by the SIGINT board and the Secretariat of the Cipher Policy Board. So there was already a significant footprint of our organisation there anyway. But in 1946, GCNCS became GCHQ formally, and we had a significant reorganisation with all the demobilisation after the war. A new divisional structure had been brought in, which was using vertical groups based on function, horizontal divisions based on tasks, which were grouped geographically. But Berkeley Street didn't really close formally until late 1946. But we talked there about Denniston's legacy, but I don't think it's ever really been talked about enough that the work that this fairly small niche group of personnel within GCNCS, their work was invaluable. Significantly important intelligence for the Foreign Office, for the Joint Intelligence Committee, and for the Ministry of Economic Warfare, and really help plot the economic and diplomatic progress of the war.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.